Why I have this more general title is because my talk will be split into two parts. The first is to explain the estimation techniques, in particular how this improved estimator came about, how it was derived to saturate the Kramer-Allen equality, and then sort of talk about this in general, and then how also the bispectrum relates to the trispectrum now that we have actually have a detection of FNL. And then the second part, which is related to the title on the schedule, which is point source contamination, and talk about this is work I'm currently doing with Elena Pierpaoli, talk about how to basically produce bispectra that are very similar in form to the local model. One of the reasons why we haven't found a large contamination of FNL is basically because the underlying bispectra are in a certain sense orthogonal to the local model. And therefore, even though they might have a larger absolute amplitude, the contamination is just not going to be that large. And then, not to spoil things, I can say that these different bispectra that we've looked at can't explain the new results that we've heard about earlier. Okay, so just to orient everyone about not just what is non-Gaussianity, but what does it really mean to estimate these parameters? I'll have a very general introduction, which is probably good because now there's more of a mixed crowd. The basic idea is that cosmological observations, whether it's the CMB, galaxies, are a random realization of some underlying probability distribution function. This means that the exact temperature anisotropy in a given direction is meaningless. Just because it's a random realization. And this PDF is parameterized by fixed, but possibly unknown or unknown quantities, such as the power spectrum, or maybe something like omega matter, omega baryon, things that we could use to calculate the power spectrum. And the only information in the data is information that can be used to estimate these parameters. So the only information in the CMB maps are information that we can use to estimate the power spectra. And if we're lucky, we can find sufficient statistics, namely simple combinations of the data, which contain all the possible information in the complete maps or the data sets about these parameters that we actually care about. So Gaussianity implies that the ALMs have a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And then isotropy implies that each of these ALMs is going to be independently distributed. So basically, in that case, the covariance matrix becomes diagonal, and therefore the PDF can be factorized. And so each of these ALMs can be estimated or sort of predicted independently of one another. Therefore, a Gaussian PDF is going to be completely described by the CLs, and the Gaussian data is going to be completely described by some sort of estimate of the CLs. Okay, so non-Gaussianity simply means that last statement is violated in some form. So basically that the data contains a higher order endpoint correlation function, or connected one. So this means that either one of the odd endpoint correlation functions, the bispectrum or the five-point function, is non-zero, or once we've subtracted off the two-point correlation function from the four-point correlation function, there's nothing remaining. A really intuitive way of thinking about the non-Gaussianity is that it produces an anisotropic power spectrum. So the power spectrum will be different in different regions, and that these differences are going to correlate with something else in the map. So say for the local model, the power spectrum is different, and those differences correlate with the large-scale CMB anisotropies, and that's what produces the bispectrum. Another form of non-Gaussianity, which I've done a lot of work on, is the non-Gaussianity produced by gravitational lensing. There, the power spectrum varies, and the variation of the power spectrum depends on the lens potential. And so in that case, instead of producing a bispectrum, you produce a trispectrum. But the intuitive way of thinking about it is that the non-Gaussianity makes the power spectrum vary across the sky, and that exactly how that varies determines the precise form of the non-Gaussianity. Yeah.
Is that true for equilateral
FNL? No, it's you can't really think about it in the same way. It's really just for the local model that you could think about it in that manner. Okay, so on to optimal estimators. So all the potential information, say that WMAP is measured, will be in their full sky maps, or also something that completely represents those full sky maps, say like the endpoint correlation functions or the full likelihood function. Now, it's just not possible to actually go and deal with this infinite set of endpoint correlation functions. So perhaps an efficient estimator, something that we can evaluate rapidly, will contain all the original information in the full data set. So this can be sort of searched for by looking at the so-called Kramer-Rao inequality. So any estimator, capital lambda, which can depend on the data for this parameter, little lambda, which parameterizes the PDF, is something that we care about, must satisfy the so-called Kramer-Rao inequality, namely that the variance of this estimator has to be greater than or equal to 1 over the Fisher matrix, which is defined essentially as the expectation value of this quantity, where now p is your probability distribution function. So this is a theorem. There's no getting around this. So if you found a estimator that saturates this bound, you can say, okay, this is all the information that's in the data. So the Kramer-Rao inequality? Yeah. No, it's just completely general.
But an efficient matrix doesn't make any sense for completely non-Gaussian. I mean, you could have very long extended.
Well, you're thinking of the Bayesian interpretation of the likelihood function in terms of representing the errors by the curvature.
But when you say variance, so I think variance.
This is solely a frequentist understanding of probability. So it's. It's a very general theorem. Okay, so the Kramer-Rao inequality basically comes from the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, which is just tells us that the dot product between two vectors squared has to be less than the square of each of these vectors. And so to prove this, basically you want to generalize what you mean by the dot product to the expectation value over the distribution. But it's quite simple. So if you allow A to basically be this quantity, which shows up in the variance, B to be this quantity, which shows up in the Fisher matrix, you can show that this term has to be 1, therefore that the variance has to be greater than or equal to 1 over the Fisher matrix here. So that's it. And therefore, you can find a necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of an optimal estimator, namely that based on the measure which you're doing this average over, that A and B have to somehow be collinear. So this necessary and sufficient condition basically tells us that the derivative of the log PDF has to only depend on the data like this, the quantity that goes into to the variance. And then what's multiplying it is simply the Fisher matrix. Okay, so, and I'm sorry, I have so many equations up here. But for the local model, and the exact PDF can quite simply be written down. So here, phi is our Gaussian field. And this delta function basically enforces the definition of the local model. And here is the PDF for the Gaussian field. And so one can expand this. And here we've expanded the log likelihood function and find all the contributions as a expansion in FNL. And moreover, assuming linear radiative transfer, the statistics of this field will exactly mirror the statistics of the observed CMB will exactly mirror the statistics of this underlying field. And so you can also implement radiative transfer in a similar fashion, where these are actually the exact same alpha L functions that Ben and Ichiro showed this morning. And once again, you can expand this, and you can find that to lowest order in FNL, and you can find a term that looks like this. And so what happens is we can satisfy this necessary and sufficient condition if we ignore terms that are FNL squared times A, where A turns out to be this is sort of the appropriate dimensionless thing you want to, or quantity you want to expand in. A is just sort of the characteristic amplitude of the power spectrum, 10 to the minus 10. So this is the estimator that WMAP first used, and this is essentially the exact same estimator that Ben described before. So this is here we have the reduced bispectrum produced by the local model. Here is the variance. So the weight function is basically just a signal-to-noise weighting. And the interesting thing is, for the local model, you can rewrite this weight function, the signal-to-noise weighting, and describe it in the terms that Ben spoke about this morning, where you take the observed ALMs, you essentially Wiener filter them, you get an estimate for the gravitational potential, you square that, then you go back and you calculate what is the what are the ALMs just coming from the quadratic term in the potential, and then you cross-correlate that with the observed ALMs, and that's your estimator. So I was quite surprised when I found that even though we got back the estimator that WMAP used, there was also this additional linear term. Now with the correct additional factor of 2 there. So this was first derived in the paper that I mentioned, or I had cited before, Babich 2005. And in this case, so when in the ideal case where you have full sky and homogeneous noise, it turns out that that this linear piece has to be proportional to the monopole, which, as I mentioned before, is unobservable. It's just basically whenever you have an average over the sky, if everything's isotropic, that average has to be equal to the monopole. Okay. So it's only when we violate isotropy, either due to a galactic sky cutter and homogeneous noise, that we get this additional linear term, which does improve the variance. So this works because it essentially eliminates spurious correlations between the CMB and inhomogeneous noise. So as one would expect, that there are no correlations in reality, and this is why this does not produce a bias. So the expectation value of this linear term vanishes, but it does affect the variance by eliminating these spurious correlations, which we know are not real. So as I mentioned, this estimator satisfies satisfies the Kramer-Rao inequality. Therefore, it contains all the information once we've ignored these terms, this FNL squared terms. So the interpretation of this is this estimator is optimal. It contains all the possible information when we're putting upper limits on FNL on perfectly Gaussian data. But now that we have a detection, there are other estimators, other techniques that can be complementary to this. So the other estimator that people are very interested in is the tri-spectrum. So Itro had basically showed that there is additional information in the tri-spectrum that becomes important once we have enough signal to noise to have a detection of FNL. Once this quantity here, which is essentially the signal to noise, is order unity, and once the non-Gaussian noise properties, right, when you're looking at the tri-spectrum, you're looking at the four-point function, the variance of the four-point function is the eight-point function, and it turns out that the tri-spectrum itself should also contribute to its noise properties. It's not just the Gaussian noise. And once that's all properly included, it turns out that the bispectrum and the tri-spectrum have similar importance once we have a detection. Now, there's a simple heuristic argument to understand why the three-point function and this weak non-Gaussian limit contains all the possible information. So the basic way, so there's a similar proof that Max Tegmark proved in, I believe, 98, where he showed that the quadratic estimator is optimal to, so basically the two-point function is optimal to estimate the power spectrum of the CMB or the galaxy power spectrum, or the galaxy redshift surveys. And so the way of understanding that is that for Gaussian fluctuations, you only have non-zero even endpoint correlation functions, and that for Gaussian fluctuations, they're always going to decompose into combinations the two-point function. So the four-point function can be written like the product of two two-point functions, the six-point function, product of three two-point functions. And so once I've measured the two-point function, I can use that to predict all the higher order endpoint correlation functions, which contain all the possible information in your data set. And that's essentially why the two-point function is optimal. So there's a similar way of thinking about the three-point function of, as an estimator for FNL. So to first order in FNL, it contributes to all of the odd endpoint correlation functions and not at all to the even endpoint correlation functions. But it doesn't produce a connected five-point function. The five-point function it produces is a three-point function times a two-point function. So once again, once I've measured the three-point function, I can use this to predict all of the other odd endpoint correlation functions, which depend on FNL, and therefore they become redundant.
Okay,
so that was sort of a basic overview of these estimators that people have used. So now on to the second, Yonash.
Right now, should we start calculating trace because we have a detection of
what?
Because we have a detection of FNL, should we start calculating trace spectrum? It's going to be just a
yes. Second. Yeah, and it's nice because then
and independent.
Yeah, if everything agrees that it's really a sort of a boost of confidence. In
so it
results.
Wouldn't be a waste of time. That's what you're saying.
What's that?
It wouldn't be a waste of time now that we have a detection.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are.
It's going to take a lot of time, but
but I mean, come on. I mean, by spectrum to be completely zero, you still have price. That's entirely possible.
But that's a different kind of that. Yeah.
Sure. Yes.
Can you go back to the slide? If the two-point function you say you can be, well, you can still get it as a product, two-point times three-point, five-point. Is that only true for FNL type, or is it generally true for all types?
Well, certainly true for, I mean, at order FNL cubed, right, you're going to have a contribution there. So certainly for weak FNL.
So is it just general non-Gaussianity?
Yeah.
You could surely have a connected pipe.
Yeah, I mean, generically, I would say that it's this is only applies to FNL. Okay, so on to the second part of the talk, point source contamination. This is work that I've been doing with Ellen at Fiorapoli. So the radio point source Poisson fluctuation bias spectrum is relatively large. I mean, this was detected. And Komatsu 03, where there was no detection of FNL. But there's not much contamination of the FNL estimator, essentially because the shapes are orthogonal. I mean, this is why myself, Paolo Criminelli, and Matteo Soliraga define these other the equilateral configuration, just because if you use the local model estimator, the weight functions are wrong, and you're going to get a biased answer. And so you need to be careful about how you're doing the estimation, what weight functions you use. So, I mean, this is good in order to eliminate possible contaminations. So Elena and I sat down and thought, well, okay, what is the basic physics which is producing the local model during inflation? Well, basically what's going on is you have a single inflaton mode which is freezes out early. And that due to causality, the only way that that single inflaton mode, which is frozen out, can affect the small scale dynamics is by essentially by changing the energy density in that region. And so the change of that energy density will change the power spectrum of the small scale inflaton modes. And so there needs to be some sort of coupling between those two. And that coupling is the FNL parameter. And so we thought, okay, maybe the Poisson fluctuation contribution does not will not contaminate the estimator because it's orthogonal. But is there some way we can sort of reproduce the basic idea or the basic mechanism which is producing the local model non-Gaussianity during the epoch of inflation? And there is. So essentially, that there are cross correlations between large-scale features, either due to gravitational lensing or due to simple biasing, which will affect the small-scale power spectrum, and then those will be correlated with the large-scale CMB anisotropies via the ISW effect. And this is going to produce a bispectra similar to the local model, namely, it's going to be the sort of the product of two power spectra. And essentially, we looked at both radio point sources and SD clusters. As Ben mentioned, for WMAP resolution, SC clusters basically look like point sources. Okay, so the Poisson fluctuation power spectrum depends on the local intrinsic source density. Yeah.
Power cost is at that not like point sources.
Yeah, and you can do the calculation and everything works out. It's just that was our original thought process.
I see, but you actually include that actually the size of the cluster?
Then? Yeah. Okay. So we use the power spectrum, the Tomasi power spectrum. Mm-hmm. Includes all that stuff.
Both the clustering or just one point?
Just the one point, just the Poisson fluctuations. Okay, so the Poisson fluctuation power spectrum will simply depend on the local number density of sources. And this is what makes the power spectrum anisotropic. And so there are different ways that this will occur. So either we can have a bias. So this is the large-scale matter overdensity. And so this is going to, regions that are intrinsically overdense are going to have more radio point sources, and vice versa for underdense regions.
Also, gravitational lensing is going to dilute sources, basically because you're not going to change the number of radio point sources in a region, but the positive convergence is going to magnify that region and decrease the number density. And so that's going to, the positive convergence is going to decrease your Poisson fluctuation power spectrum. What?
There's another piece over there.
Another piece over
there. This gravitational lensing, you can probe to a deeper magnitude. So it's not
So we also
the volume effect. It's not just the volume effect.
Yeah, exactly. So it also changes the flux cut.
Right.
But it does that for radio point sources, which we remove. For SC clusters, it doesn't. Right. Because we don't identify that. So now both the matter over density and the convergence will correlate with the ISW effect, and so this is going to produce a bispectrum, which looks very similar to the local model. So the first thing we call the density modulation. This is the bias effect. And so you can just go and write the cross correlation between the ISW effect, which depends on the change in on the growth function with respect to redshift, and also the number density of the redshift distribution of the point sources, and that this will produce a bispectrum that looks like this. So it's essentially the Poisson fluctuation power spectrum plus the permutations of the cross correlations. As I mentioned before, this factors like the local model. So here's the cross correlations. This is for SC clusters, and then these are for two different models of the redshift distribution of point sources. Unfortunately, this is not very well known. The redshift properties and also even the distribution of the point sources that are the radio point sources that are relevant for higher frequencies, but we use sort of two different models and it really didn't matter much. But the SE clusters come from much lower redshift where we're in a dark energy dominated regime where the gravitational potential is evolving and therefore ISW fluctuations are being produced, and this is why there's a greater cross correlation between the SZ clusters than between the radio point sources, which are tend to be more located around redshift 1.
And so this is essentially equilateral configuration for the bispectrum. This is the local model. This is the cross correlation produced for the SZ clusters. And this is for the two models of radio point sources. And so you can see that they're comparable in size to the local model. This is for FNL of 1, especially once you get out to much higher L. But for the scales that are relevant for WMAP today at L of 500, it's really an order of magnitude below. Okay, so the second part is the magnification modulation is what we call it. So again, you can write down the cross correlation between the ISW effect and the convergence. And this leads to a different bispectrum, similar in form. Here is the change in the, this is due to the effect that I showed before, basically that you're diluting point sources. This is why it's a negative sign. And then there's this additional term that Asafa mentioned, namely that you're changing the flux cutoff. So in regions that are where things are being magnified, it's easier to observe and eliminate those point sources. So this effect, or this term, is going to be there for the radio point sources, but not for the SE clusters. So again, here is the cross correlation. Now basically the relative amplitude has reversed itself, and it's easy to understand because essentially you want to put the point source to higher redshifts because it's going to pass by more matter, therefore be magnified more. And so the radio point sources, which tend to be at higher.
You should include it for point sources but not the SE clusters.
That effect comes because in regions that are highly magnified, you basically are eliminating point sources that will have a lower intrinsic luminosity.
But you're not really
it's
common.
It's a second order effect. On the
it's a second order effect.
It's just stochastic reflection.
Stochastic
reflection.
Where is it going? So you're not really detecting any of these sources, right?
The radio point sources?
Yeah, they
remove them from.
Okay, so you're saying about the ones that are removing. But yeah. I thought you were talking about unresolved ones. So.
Yeah, no, but you have to determine. I mean, how you have identified those, removed those, and that depends on a constant flux cutoff,
okay.
Which is now different in different regions. But it's not there for SE clusters because we're not identifying them and removing them.
So this is actually interesting. You're going to use this to estimate the potential bias that you could introduce by identifying point sources in the CMU, right? The kind of effect you pointed out.
Yes. And there was another thing that we calculated that didn't follow through to the end, namely that in removing, it's not just the magnification which is going to sort of change the true flux cutoff. It's also going to be the local CMB and instrument noise. And it turns out that if you do the most naive thing, that's also going to produce a bispectrum that looks like the local model. But if you filter using this Tegmark procedure, then which was designed to remove the large-scale CMB modes, then you do not produce something that looks like the local model. You produce something that looks like Poisson fluctuations. It's constant. So that was nice. That was a potentially large campaign. Again, this is the these are various bispectra. This is the local model for FML1, these are the radio point sources, and this is the SE clusters. And again, and I'll show something more quantitative in a few slides. But as you can guess, as things are today, it's not that important.
So this is correlation with ISW, or
yes,
no? Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's ISW point source. That's the theory.
Yeah, but the coupling is produced via the bias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could have just point source. I mean, that's what you offer.
And then with the free point source contributions, you have sort of various effects that are coupling them, either just due to the underlying three-point function or Poisson fluctuation.
Yeah.
Okay, so estimator bias. So you just essentially take the wave functions as evaluated for the local model, plug in the different bispectra, get the change in FNL. And so this is for WMAP and for the various effects. There is no way we can find that to become larger than FNL of 1, which we were disappointed with, I guess you guys are now. even when you go out the Planck, the effect, even when you look here, you think, okay, well, Planck's going to go out to say FNL 1500, this is going to become a large effect. But here I plotted the absolute value of the local model. And so this is going to change sign. And so this essentially protects the estimator from the contaminants which have a single sign, because it's kind of like you're integrating something over cosine. As you integrate over many cycles, it just vanishes. And so the exact numbers aren't done yet for planning, but it's not really going to be large for planning as well. And I think something to really point out is that the fact that the bias spectrum coming from not just a local model, but really anything which has the signature of acoustic oscillations is going to change sign. And so even as we go to smaller scales, that's really going to prevent large contamination.
Daniel, can I ask a question? Yeah. So when you compute bias, you assume your fiducial model is one where point sources were not modeled at all. Is that correct?
Yeah.
This is the maximum possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you just take these bias graphs, you plug it in, and you figure out what comes out.
What are you assuming for the bias? Like a factor of 1 or 2?
Well, we used 1.7, which is what's been measured for the lower NDSS sources, which no one really knows what's the bias of a higher frequency.
But this is all for ISW, right? This is all correlation with ISW, is that right?
Yes, so basically the anisotropies in the power spectra are turned into a bias spectrum because those anisotropies correlate with the ISW.
That's right, but so you could get, just forget about ISW, just SC, 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 or point source SC, or the thing, combination of factors, they could be much bigger.
Yes, possibly having the third thing come from
the
third
tail. That's very small. That's the thing.
If it comes from that C effect, it might be larger. Yeah. I mean, the problem when you go from the power spectrum to the bias spectrum, there's so many different terms.
Sure, yeah.
So conclusions. So for the low signal to noise ratio, the current estimator is optimal. However, when I say optimal, it really does satisfy a theorem. But now that we have detection, there are other things one can do, namely measure tri-spectrum or Minkowski functionals, and those will contain independent information. And then the second part of the talk is that cross-correlations between the ISW effect and then things that are making the Poisson fluctuation power spectrum anisotropic produce bi-spectra that are quite similar to the local model. And that detection that was first reported by Yana and Wena cannot be explained by any of the bias structure that we considered here. Thank you.
Questions?
There's no detection.
What?
There's no detection.
Okay, well.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I think Ben would disagree.
Yeah.
Ben, you should disagree.
The title of the title is the title of the paper. I mean, it says at what level of statistical significance, whether you consider the protection or not, that's your prerogative.
Any more questions?
Derek, just out of curiosity, those power spectra for point sources, are there varying acoustic oscillations in them?
In the...
The ones you showed, varying power spectra.
Oh, no, so it's just Poisson fluctuation. So there are no clustering terms.
Ah, okay.
But those will do very little.
They'll be tiny, right?
And they get integrated out because it's
they
project.
They get integrated out, right. But just the principle, I was wondering, okay.
Okay, so if there is no more question, then we can move on to the sample. Let's find. Yeah, okay.